And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This weekend's box office news is all about The Heat, which made almost $40 million and kicked Channing Tatum in the booty. So we'll talk about that movie, Melissa McCarthy and Sandra Bullock, Paul Feig, and maybe whether anybody will learn the lesson this time that women attend movies. We'll then hop from one hot topic to another as we visit one of the most controversial blog posts I've ever written and go plinko, plinko, plinkoing down memory lane with one of television's most popular and enduring game shows. And as always, we'll close with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I cover movies and such like for NPR.org, and I sit here wondering whether historic Studio 44 is going to become a thing.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I wonder nothing, and I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, it's awfully good to see everyone. We have our producer, Jess Gittner, back in the studio after her world travels.
Hey, Jess.
Hi, and, Jess. We're all waving to Jess. You can't see it.
You can't see it, but we're all doing it, and we mean it very sincerely, and we mean thanks to Nick Fountain, who helped us out last week. But this week, we are here, gathered in this room, to talk about The Heat, a movie that, as soon as I saw it, I immediately told everyone else that they were going to have to see it as well, because I wanted to talk about it on the podcast. I have written about the movie on the blog. I saw it with Stephen and with Glenn. So for that reason, I'm going to go directly to Trey first, because he's the only person I feel like I have absolutely no idea how he responded to this movie. Trey Graham.
I was not able to see it with you all because at roughly the same time you were seeing it, I was seeing it in Georgetown with a gang of the boys, shall we call them. And let me tell you, if you have not gone to Georgetown with a bunch of gentlemen who may or may not have spent earlier parts of the day on Saturday having a bibulous brunch, that is how you should see this movie, because it was a little uproarious.
Did you enjoy the movie?
Yes.
Now that you've reviewed the social event.
Yes, I quite liked the movie. And we had a fine, uproarious time. I will tell you that the entire row of guys I was sitting with, there's a scene where one of the leads is trapped. Mm-hmm. Actually, they're both trapped. They're tied up. They've mm-hmm. been taken prisoner by the big bad.
Would you mind holding this for me?
My hands are tied, but I can...
Oh, okay. Let me help you.
Jesus.
Thanks.
Breathe through the pain. Breathe through the pain.
Yeah, do that. Do that. Do that. Breathe it out. Breathe it out. Breathe it out.
Okay, Mons.
And let's just say an unorthodox method is employed to distract from the fact that they're about to escape.
Right.
When this thing happens, the entire row I was sitting with erupted as one with a gigantic, oh!
Yes. Mm-hmm. There is a certain amount of that. And the fellas that I was sitting with chuckled at that as well. Glenn.
Yep.
What did you think of the movie?
I liked it. I liked it. You know, you made the point in your post that this is a buddy cop film, and that could have been made with two dudes. Mm-hmm. It wasn't. If it had been made with two dudes, I wouldn't have gone to see it, because I feel about the buddy cop genre the way a lot of people feel about the superhero genre. It's like it doesn't have anything to give. It's not surrendering more information anymore. It's, you know, and whenever the plot mechanics of the buddy cop movie kicked in, you know, you're off the case.
Right.
Where's the drug shipment coming?
Which is almost meta commentary.
Exactly.
At this point.
Right. But that's the thing. I sat there going, hey, where's it? Where's the joke? All the time. But I really, really enjoyed it. You know, Paul Feig is making the rounds, the director is making the rounds of the podcast. He was interviewed by the AV Club this week. And he said about physical comedy that it can't seem too sweaty. I thought that was a really nice way of putting it. You can't seem like you're trying too hard. Mm-hmm. And both of these actresses did a really good job with the physical comedy aspects of this thing. Mm-hmm. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Stephen Thompson.
Yeah, I absolutely loved this movie. I just had a blast the entire time. It's exactly what I was talking about during our summer movie preview when I was saying that the big hit of the summer, now this is not necessarily the big hit of the summer, but is a big hit of the summer, is going to be fun. It is going to represent actual escapism from grim and dark and awful things. And there's nothing wrong with movies about grim and dark and awful things, but this is a purely fun, purely engaging, purely escapist, silly movie. And I think the familiarity of the structure, the fact that it is a familiar buddy cop movie in every way except the casting, and the fact that it is funnier than most buddy cop movies.
Right, I agree.
That formula is very comforting. other than the fact that there are some squirm-inducingly bloody moments, which are played largely for laughs, to me, it felt like a very comfortable place to be at the movies.
Yeah,
I gotta say, in a way, you can just sort of take the buddy cop thing and put it over on the side. Yeah. You know where it's going. You know how that's going to unfold, right? Mm-hmm. So you get to dig in. You get to sort of relax and watch these two very funny women do their work. And, you know, Glenn mentioned physical comedy, but it's not just physical comedy. One of the great things about this movie is that Sandra Bullock, Oscar winner, is content to basically play straight man to Melissa McCarthy, who has this very particular type of verbal comedy. Mm-hmm. And Paul Feig knows exactly how to shape it so it never becomes quite too much. Mm-hmm. If you've seen the sort of the credit roll or whatever the end tag was in Bridesmaids where she's going on with the Sky Marshal, who is her husband in real life, you know that what she does is she sort of latches on to an idea and she riffs on it and then she twists it and she digs under it and then she takes another pass at it from a side angle and it just gets funnier and funnier and funnier.
Yeah.
So she does that and he shapes it and they make these just little gems of scenes that never outstay their welcome. I really liked this movie.
Yeah. It is true. The crime story, the cop story is all sort of pointless and unnecessary and it doesn't really satisfy. But you know, how strongly do people remember the story from Beverly Hills Cop or the story from 48 Hours or the story from Lethal Weapon?
I couldn't tell you what Lethal Weapon is about.
I remember Lethal Weapon 2 because it has, diplomatic immunity.
And I remember Beverly Hills Cop because it has Stephen Berkoff.
Right.
And,
but they're just an excuse for a series of
vehicles.
Some combination of action sequences and comedy sequences. And in this one, it's mostly comedy sequences. So really what you get is a series of really good sketches, right? Mm-hmm. The sketch where they're in the captain's office and Melissa McCarthy is sort of raging about him. The sketch where they're in the bathroom at the club.
I'm going to help you.
What are you doing? What are you doing? What are you
doing?
What are you
doing? I just want
you to shut up. Oh, my God. I only brought five of these to Boston.
I'll cut the other four.
Okay, would you just stop carving up my clothes?
I'm making shorts. Everybody likes shorts.
Oh,
Jesus, hold still.
Oh, please, just... Well, hey. That feels awkward, weird. Just don't touch that area.
Well, don't duck down. You're going to suck my hand up there.
The sketch where they're getting drunk at the bar. It's just a series of setups, and that sounds kind of diminishing, but it's not, because they're really executed very, very well. And I just laughed and laughed and laughed. I've now seen it twice because I saw it with Stephen and Glenn, and I had seen it at a preview as well. I mean, and I eagerly went to see it again, and it was just as funny, and I enjoyed it just as much. And there were a couple of reviews. I was disappointed in some of the reviews for the movie. And one of the things that disappointed me was that several of them kind of said, well, Melissa McCarthy is funny, but nobody else is really doing anything. And I do not agree with that. I think Sandra Bullock is very funny in this movie. And I am somebody who thought she was funny in Speed. She's very funny in While You Were Sleeping. And she's very funny in Miss Congeniality, quite frankly. And the thing about Miss Congeniality is there's not enough else in that movie to hold it up, so it becomes real dumb. But she's really funny in that movie. And in fact, one of my friends was talking about a moment she has in this movie where he said, boy, you know, I liked that moment enough that I almost wanted there to be a whole movie where she was just doing that. And I said, that's what Miss Congeniality is. Because what he was referring to, he was sort of referring to she has kind of a kind of weirdly vulgar kind of moment. Mm-hmm. And I said, that's the Miss Congeniality thing she did, which as much as people complain about it, and much of the rest of that movie is garbage. That's true. But she's very funny in it. And I think she's really funny in this. And
she's super funny in The Proposal, too. People have forgotten that movie.
I think they're both holding up. They're part of this, although obviously it is a Melissa McCarthy movie. She's the one where they just hold on her and she just is funny and is funny and is funny. And it reminds me of, you know, what they used to do with like Eddie Murphy and Steve Martin and guys like that, where you just put them on screen, they do their thing, and they just are explosively funny and funny and funny. And she has the ability to do that.
Yeah. I don't want to take away from the script, which was written by Katie Dippold, who made her bones on Mad TV, made her boner jokes on Mad TV, but then moved on to Parks and Rec.
Yeah.
And the script is really, really good. But this movie comes alive in the casting. It warmed my heart to glimpse Hey, Jane Curtin. I would see.
Wanted more. I think you're going to get more of her in the sequel.
You have to. I just want to see Jane Curtin being that surly, bird flipping, southy Jane Curtin. They need to. This is 40 that right now. They need to. They need to give us something like that. That was awesome. But I mean, so many actors who are really, really good who have little tiny bit parts. Dan Bacchanal from The Daily Show and also on Veep as the evil albino.
And I will say, I do have one friend who thinks that the evil albino is offensive. I will.
Oh, yeah. I was mildly troubled by the evil albino, although it is deliberately played for jokes about how the evil albino
stereotype
is a trope.
It's true.
It's great that they got Michael Rapaport to play the Michael Rapaport role.
It's true.
Because that's such a Michael Rapaport role.
It's true.
John Ross Bauer, who we've called out on the show before, Nate Cordery, Caitlin Olson from It's Always Sunny, Bill Burr, Ben Falcone, we talked about Jamie Denbo and Jessica Chaffin, who are great, hilarious as Ron and Beverly. Tony Hale turns up.
Yes.
Just exactly when you want to see
some Tony
Hale.
Oh, that scene is, speaking of just sketches that just exist in this, that scene between Melissa McCarthy and Tony Hale is so funny and so
Well, and it
weird.
Sets the scene for who she is in this movie. Mm-hmm.
But it's independently so funny and, oh my gosh. And don't forget Joey McIntyre.
Well, I tried to, but okay.
There is a Wayans in this movie.
There is.
Yes, Marlon Wayans is
and
in this
doing
movie.
Doing... Graceful,
yes.
Subtle, nice, charming work.
Excuse me, Esper. I was wondering if you would.
Oh, okay, this is awkward. Nothing personal, but as a rule, I make it a point not to date my coworkers. So, thank you.
I was wondering if you would not talk to me in that tone.
Oh, yes, of course.
It's a little different.
Of course, yeah. No, I wouldn't. Why would I?
Why would you?
I wouldn't. Just. We should go to the paint factory.
Well, are we clear here? Because I don't. It got real awkward.
No, it's
between
you guys.
We're
all good, right?
We're
really good.
Same page.
Absolutely true.
I like almost everything about this movie except for the sequence. The one sequence that totally didn't work for me is the one that involves one of the characters dragging herself through a hospital corridor without the use of her legs. I didn't understand why it was necessary except to slow down that particular
sequence. I thought it was... I liked parts of that sequence. And what I love about that sequence is that is, I think we can say, that is a Sandra Bullock moment.
Okay.
She's doing a sort of a physical comedy bit that involves crawling around on the floor.
Yeah.
And when I watched that, I thought, if Melissa McCarthy did this, they would say, that's just fat lady flopping around on the floor, and they'd never do that with a skinny lady because it wouldn't be funny.
So they put it in the movie because of that.
And I loved the fact that you could look at it and say, no, they're both funny in this movie.
Yeah.
And there are so many things, in addition to how much I just loved watching it and thought it was funny, there are so many things I appreciate about kind of the subtle... It's not politics, that's too heavy a word, kind of the subtle approach, the ethic of this movie, that they've done this buddy cop comedy where, as I said in the post, 95% of the comedy, A, you could do with guys, B, you could do with skinny guys. It's not about either the fact that these are women, it's not about Melissa McCarthy being a bigger lady, it's not about, you know, she flops on the floor, which is something she's been willing to do and she can do and be funny.
But it's not
about that. It's about other things and it's about the other aspects of her comedy presence, and I love that about it.
Well, there's so many subtle tweaks in this movie and tweaks of cliches. There's a great toppling of the fruit cart.
Yeah.
Yes. Which, oh my God.
And it's not giving anything away to say this, but you know, in every 80s buddy cop movie, there's a chase and then the fruit cart gets smashed. Uh-huh. And this is sort of this slow motion dismantling of a fruit cart. That is
with a callback in the next scene that is the funniest, like this casual aside of a callback that's so funny.
Yeah.
Because it almost goes unremarked.
I do want to say
as many times as I laughed in this movie, nothing made me laugh harder than after the movie walking down the street with Linda Holmes and Glenn Weldon, all, you know, socializing together, and the reaction that Glenn had, a child squealed with delight, like, and Glenn completely not thinking just goes,
in my defense, it was an involuntary reaction to a blood-curdling scream.
It's just like, oh, joy.
But to return to things that are not about Glenn, I also enjoyed the use of female hip-hop and rap on the soundtrack.
Yeah, that was a really nice touch.
Which is a very kind of, you know, because these movies tend to have hip-hop and rap soundtracks for whatever you think of that. They tend to have it. And this had largely women. Excellent use of Groove Is in the Heart.
Oh, which we just talked about.
I just talked about how much I love it. to me, it is a, it's almost like it's perfect that there are a couple jokes in this movie that I wish they hadn't done, you know, mm-hmm. but perhaps the albino business,
right.
because that's how this kind of movie always ends.
Right.
You watch it and you think it's really funny. It's really awesome. There's a couple things I wish they hadn't done,
right.
but you know, that's
but
small
that,
potatoes
but that line
compared
moves, that
to...
line moves for different people. You know, there
absolutely.
Are, there are a lot of people who are not going to be offended by anything. In
no,
it.
Of course. And I think, you know, how much you are bothered by things like that depends on a wide variety of factors. And I wasn't like super offended
right.
by it, but it's the kind of thing like, yeah, if I make this movie, they don't do that joke
right.
like two or three times. But it's like that's because there's a billion jokes in it and everybody's got their own taste in
yeah.
jokes.
Well, when you talk about subtle tweaks, even something as simple as the casting of Sandra Bullock and Marlon Wayans. And Marlon Wayans is sort of... her love interest.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to see if we can name if we can name any movies in which the female character has a love interest who is younger than her.
Yeah. Mm. That's a good point.
Well, other than the one that she did with Ryan Reynolds.
Well, yeah, that's true.
But other than involving, I think, her in that role, that's certainly not common. It's there, but I mean, there are just a bunch of things about this movie that are interesting and thoughtful and clearly... effort went into it. And...
Speaking of interesting and thoughtful, I don't want to let this pass because Linda has walked right up to the edge of saying it but hasn't quite said it again. In her blog post about this movie, she said something that I think was really on point and really elegantly put. It had to do with Melissa McCarthy and those moments where she tips over into vulgarism and Linda sort of preemptively defending her against charges that she shouldn't go there. Mm-hmm. Linda said, basically, if we're going to trust this woman and respect her as a comedian, we have to trust her to have the taste and the skill and the instincts to do those things. And I thought that was so well put that I just wanted to call it out for those of you who didn't see it on the blog.
Well, yeah. I mean, there is a thing that has happened sometimes with Melissa McCarthy where if you watch her on Saturday Night Live or you watch her riff, she loves dirty, filthy jokes. She loves filthy jokes. She loves playing weird, weird people like Kristen Wiig does. But there have been times when she's done that and people say like, oh, she just is making herself a disgusting caricature of the fat lady or whatever.
Right.
And to me, you have to respect the fact that she's allowed to do that, just like Kristen Wiig is allowed to do it, just like Maya Rudolph is allowed to do it. She has to be allowed to do those things. And as long as it's clear that she has kind of some comedic control over it.
Right.
And it's her, it's very much her vision. I mean, Paul Feig, I think, and I've never spoken to him about this, but reveres her.
Yeah.
And when you watch her with this director and this writer who respect her so much, she's in control of those moments where she decides she's going to be kind of filthy and vulgar and
right.
all that stuff. Because that's what makes her so funny when she... When she was on the Gilmore Girls, she was sort of this sweetie pie mm-hmm. of a lady. And it's when you uncork the fact that she has those dimples.
Mm-hmm.
And when she's in that early scene with Tony Hale, she just keeps giggling and her dimples are, you know, big enough to pour tea into.
Right.
And yet she's also got this kind of hysterically funny undercurrent of reaching out and grabbing you and yanking you out of the car. So it's... I think as long as she has comedic control over
yeah.
it, she's got to be allowed to do that. You can't say it's fine as long as you're playing somebody like you did on Gilmore Girls, as long as it's somebody like on Mike and Molly, where she's pretty and she's above board and she's the smart
right.
one and the respected one and everyone talks about her and how pretty she is. Like, there's a difference between her being like she was an Identity Thief,
right.
which is not a good movie.
Right.
Where she is a grotesque, and it doesn't feel respectful of her talent at all. It does feel like, it's hard to explain, but it doesn't feel like it's as much her sensibility. Whereas this really feels to me like her sensibility. I think this is her being exactly the kind of funny she prefers to be, and that's fine.
And this movie is a gigantic surprise hit. Hey, Linda, how do you feel about the fact that this movie is such a shocking surprise hit?
Well, yeah.
Okay. How it
shocking to whom?
How it performed so much over expectations.
Yeah. So this movie made a little over $39 million. Biggest opening ever for McCarthy. Biggest opening
which includes
ever,
Bridesmaids and Identity
correct.
Thief, which were both
correct.
Huge hits.
Correct.
Yep.
Biggest opening ever for Melissa McCarthy. Biggest opening ever for Paul Feig. Biggest opening ever for Sandra Bullock. And so big success, right? Absolutely spanked White House Down, which was the other biggest movie coming out this weekend, which is the thriller. It looks like it's Die Hard in the White House. It's Channing Tatum running around with Jamie Foxx because, of course, the black president, because that's the only president the movies ever have. The black president, I think, is now actually an official trope of action movies.
Is it time for a lady president? We should have a lady president.
Well, there's, and I'm not going to spoil it, but I was having a conversation with our pal Matt Thompson about this the other day, who I think might have more to say about this, so I'm not going to spoil it. Did much better than White House Down, did much better than a lot of people thought it was going to do, and I've been hurt on this, but I fail to understand why anybody thought this wasn't going to be a hit. Because we've already had, like, oh, hey, look, a lot of people went to see Identity Thief. Oh, hey, look, a lot of people went to see The Proposal, which kind of not, people didn't expect that much from.
Right.
Like, wow, you know, women really like Sandra Bullock. Wow, you know, people really like Melissa McCarthy. That's so weird. Okay, well, here's a Melissa McCarthy and Sandra Bullock movie from the guy who made Bridesmaids.
Yeah.
Eh. You know,
we're not sure that's going to be a tentpole movie.
We don't know.
Yeah. We don't know if the ladies will turn out.
As I said on Twitter, I have now seen The Heat twice and White House Down zero times, meaning that I am America.
But you put it well when you and I talked about this the other day, Linda, where you said that White House Down, there are 80 of that.
Right.
And The Heat, there is one of that.
Right.
And so having one-onths versus 1/80th.
It's true.
In a way, it's so obvious when you think about it. There aren't more movies like this. I mean, there's another funny movie this summer.
This is the end.
There are other internship
and
well, but I mean, there are other funny movies that people think are funny. But there are like there was another White House.
Right.
There was another White House Down like 5 minutes ago.
Olympus Has Fallen from just a couple months ago. And so it's natural that all of the audience for this kind of movie is going to see this kind of movie, whereas there's naturally going to be attrition for movies like White House Down.
You make enough movies with sweaty dudes shooting each other, and they can't all make $200 million.
I've actually heard decent things about White House Down. Yeah. We shouldn't write it off entirely.
Our friend Nick Fountain liked it.
I have seen some reviews that say that it really quite works and that there's good chemistry in the leads.
Yeah.
In their defense, they did move The Heat from an April release into the summer, which shows that they believed in it to some extent.
Yep.
Oh, I think the studio did.
Okay. Yeah.
I think it's a matter of,
punditocracy.
It's the way that it gets written about.
Right.
When it's sort of like, The Heat is a surprise hit. Other surprise hits I remember. Identity Thief, The Proposal, The Devil Wears Prada, Bridesmaids, Pitch Perfect. What do these movies all have in common? Like, I mean, as I said, I've been hurt on this point.
Do they all have handsome love interests?
You know, that's the other thing, honestly, about this movie. I mean, we did make the mention of the fact that there is a little bit of flirting with Marlon Wayans.
But that's all it is.
It's
a minor plot point.
It's not a big story point. The getting of a boyfriend is a very, very minor piece of the puzzle.
It's really more a not getting of a boyfriend.
Right. And the only makeover that happens is kind of bent. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, they're getting around a lot of things. I've already been heard on the single lady. I talked in the blog post about the single lady at home in her apartment cliche that they have a lot of fun with, which is also brilliant and which I love. But anyway, no, I was extremely pleased with it. And I had such high expectations and high hopes for it that I was really ready to be disappointed. Mm-hmm. I will tell you that our pal Bob Mondello, I saw this movie sitting next to Bob, actually sitting next between Bob and Netta Ulaby, both of whom laughed through the entire thing. Mm-hmm. And before the movie, I was sort of saying to Bob, this
what
is going
to
be like,
ear to the ground.
Well, not even just that, but like, what's your guess, right? And we were both sort of like, you know, I think it'll be okay. And we got up to the scene where Melissa McCarthy is shaking the cup in the boss's office. Are they in here? And at the end of that little bit, Bob leans over and he says, I have to change my answer. It's really, really funny. So, you know, and I know Netta is a fan, so we give it a thumbs up. If you haven't seen it already, go see it instead of White House Down.
Which may be good.
We don't know.
As I said, our friend Nick Fountain is a fan. Wanted me to stop picking on White House Down. If you like Heat, come and find us on Facebook and tell us all about what you thought of this movie. We are at facebook.com/PCHH or at the blog at npr.org/PCHH. And speaking of Heat, if you like a luxurious stove as part of your kitchen setup,
wow,
you will love The Pricing Games.
Wow.
Wow, that was a segue.
On The Price is Right.
Wow.
That straightened my spine.
At the end of last week on Friday, I wrote a post on the blog, Monkey See, in which I made the point that Plinko is a terrible, stupid game. Now, if you watch The Price is Right...
Now, Linda also, it should be pointed out, Linda also hates America.
Right.
Yeah. And puppies. And
also
I'm actually the one who made the grunting noise when the baby yelled. Okay, so Plinko on The Price is Right is this stupid game where... First, you have to play a little...
I'm going to let you finish.
First, you have to play a little pricing game and you get some chips. And then you go up to the top of this big pegboard and you essentially just dump chips on a pegboard. They fall at random in a random pattern into a slot at the bottom of the board. And then either you get money or you don't get money, depending on absolutely nothing, despite the fact that Drew Carey... will stand there and go, oh, 5,000, 5,000, as if he has the ability to alter the direction of the Plinko chip.
So this is a thing that Linda went on about at some length in the post. So this is where I have to say, I am not sure whether I am happier about the fact that we are now discussing as a topic on this show
right.
something that we got to by way of a blog post in which Linda complains, among other things, about the irrationality of Plinko. As part of a post that overanalyzes Plinko to the point of irrationality.
That's right.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so I'm not
the universe
sure.
has actually
so that
folded on, in on
there's
itself.
There's that on the one hand. Yeah. I'm not sure if I'm happier about that or the fact that in the 42 and counting comments on this post
oh my God,
on Monkey See,
people are very agitated about this.
Both
post.
The statisticians and the physics majors mm-hmm. have come out mm-hmm. to discuss this game.
As yeah. well they should.
And the person who swore at me and said, I obviously never watch The Price is Right anymore.
Right.
Which is a filthy lie because I've walked past Linda's desk.
Which is a filthy lie. I'm watching it today at my desk. Stephen saw me. Plinko sucks.
Well,
I'm
no.
just gonna say.
Okay, you know what? It doesn't.
Let's hear the defense.
All right. First of all, I do understand the idea that an all Plinko episode of The Price is Right, which is what triggered this whole concept, is the figurative big bowl of cilantro. Plinko is a seasoning. You don't want an episode that's all seasoning. Now, the fact of the matter is, it is one of, what, 30,000 episodes of The Price is Right is all Plinko. It's one, you know.
41, 42 seasons.
Plinko is
like
the
that.
Worst.
Okay. Plinko is no more or less random than a lot of the pricing games on The Price
is
Right.
That is not true.
There are an awful lot. I mean, look, okay, just today I was I was having a conversation with you in which you were saying, I don't know something, and my eyes were fixed on the TV.
Because you're a dude.
Because I'm a dude, and I love The Price is Right, and
now,
I don't
see,
watch
this
it.
Now, this is why you're all lucky that we're not married, because if we were, it would be like this all the time. You were saying, I don't know, something.
I don't know. You were saying, you know, yep, yep, yep. And no, they were playing the tic-tac Tic-Tac-Toe one.
Yes.
And the grand prize is the
Secret
car.
X, Secret X,
Secret X.
Something like that.
And, you know, you get one X, which is largely valueless without a second X, because there's a hidden X in the middle of
right.
the Tic-Tac-Toe board. And then you're just guessing, is the thing $39 or is it $50? You don't know. And then,
maybe you don't.
And, you know, you have a chance to win two more X's. Ultimately, your odds are still 2 out of 3 that the X is going to line up to your liking.
But at no point during
the
playing
of random.
But at no point during the playing of that game does somebody come out with a stick to help the game
the stuck.
Be itself. To help
it's a
the game
Plinko
function.
Stick. It's a charming little bit of self-deprecation. They occasionally have to get the Plinko stick to rattle the chip loose.
The game can't be a game without outside help. That right there tells you
no,
that Plinko
that
is lame.
That doesn't always happen. No, the lame games on The Price is Right, the ones that really just boil down to flip a coin, you know, is it this much money or is it this much money? Oh, you guessed this much money.
Right. If you want to talk about lame games, there is a game among the 73, I think it is,
yep.
active games
wow.
on The Price. 73.
Uh-huh.
And there are 20-odd retired games.
Uh-huh.
Right.
But among the 73 active games on
yeah.
The Price is Right is a game called Most Expensive.
Yes.
Yeah.
The game is called
Most
Expensive.
It's called
in which
Guess
you choose
the One Which is the Most
which
Expensive.
Which of three things is the most expensive.
Right. It's a game of skill.
And that's much... But, please.
It's a game of more skill than dropping a chip on a
board. It might have been a game of skill back in the day when people owe set prices on things. But here is where I'm going to propose that The Price is Right is now completely irrelevant because we are in the age of dynamic pricing and Amazon, period.
You are the worst.
Retail prices still exist. That's ridiculous.
Retail prices. Don't believe it.
Retail prices still exist. But, I mean, there are a bunch of fairly mundane... I'm not saying Plinko is the best Price is Right game.
Because that is Cliffhanger.
And I think we do... Well, is it Cliffhanger or Mountain Climber?
Cliffhanger. It's called Cliffhanger.
Please cue the yodel. Thank you.
It is. Cliffhanger is...
Cliffhanger is awesome. Cliffhanger is a great game. I also enjoy... I mean, there are certain games that I enjoy getting all... heated up about, like 10 Chances. And I know that Linda, in her post, referenced 10 Chances in part because I used to rant about 10 Chances endlessly. 10 Chances is a game where if you just keep a cool head, it is impossible to not win.
You should win. Yeah.
The number
is that
of
the one with the punch out holes.
No.
That's a terrible
You know
game.
What? That's another Plinko right there. That's another random hole punchy.
We are discussing punch a bunch.
Is the name you were looking for? Yes, punch a bunch.
Before we move on,
no, I'm not done with 10 Chances.
Fine.
10 Chances is the game where the first one, the numbers are like 2, 4, and 0, and you can only use two of the numbers. And almost every time somebody gets up there and writes 24, stupid idiot. The number, obviously, the last number is 0. Everything in 10 Chances ends in a 0, or no one would ever win. So it's either $20 or $40, stupid. That is, you have used either one or two guesses. The next one is like 4, 5, 3, 0. Is it 350? You almost can't lose.
453. There's an amazing...
453.
There's an amazing clip of a woman playing 10 Chances in the Bob Barker era where she had no idea what she was doing.
805. Joy. Help her, audience. She needs help.
580!
Three numbers. $583. Joy. You're straying from the path here.
This is the one where you can sort of see him getting flustered,
yeah,
right?
He's losing it over how terrible she is at 10 Chances. And then at the very end, she pulls one out of thin air and wins the car.
Go ahead. 9-0. Never.
And he actually sinks.
He falls down or something, right?
On the edge of the set, and you can just see him mouthing over and over, I can't believe that. I can't believe that happened, because she looks like the dumbest person ever.
There are games that require more luck than skill, and some other games that require more skill than luck. And there is a price budget that the show has, and when they find that they're giving away too many cars, they will switch and bring out games like Rangefinder, which is a very difficult game that most people end too early, and another game called... That's Too Much.
That's Too Much is a really hard game.
It's a really hard game, and most people end that too late.
Yeah.
I found this out from an article, a really great article in Esquire magazine, the July 2010 issue of Esquire magazine.
Who else would bring you this information, Pop Culture Happy Hour listeners?
By a guy named Chris Jones about this guy and his wife who learned very quickly, soon after Drew Carey took over, they learned that Price is Right has only a fixed number of consumer products, and they repeat. So if you memorize the price, you are in. And he was famous.
It's like card counting.
It's exactly it. And he was a card counter, this guy.
Yeah.
So he guessed his showcase showdown. He guessed his showcase
to the dollar.
And ended with a 7 or something like that. It was crazy how he got it.
Yeah.
And when the show finally aired, everybody saw that Drew Carey was like not really that excited. And they were like, what? Bob Barker would have totally been so blah, blah. But Drew Carey was just pissed.
Yeah.
Because he thought the guy was cheating. He thought they had just fired a producer, so that he figured that he'd gotten some kind of information from that producer. Other thing you learn, Aaron Paul, of course. There's a great clip of Aaron Paul on The Price is Right.
From Breaking Bad.
Aaron, you're the next contestant on The Price is Right.
You're the man, Bob! Oh, you're my idol!
And Linda Cardellini won a fireplace in 1994.
I still have it.
You still have it?
Yes.
I had kept it for years in the box in my garage, and because it was the very first time I was ever on television. So once I was, you know, really an actress, I was going to put a plaque on it that said my first time on television. I'd be very proud of it. And so I kept it all these years. I never bought the plaque. And I just put it up in my house, and it looks terrible.
That's totally
awesome.
Who is
this person?
Linda Cardellini, Freaks and Geeks, on Mad Men.
All right.
Yeah. And I will say that on last summer's press tour, TCA press tour.
I'm so jealous.
We went to the Price is Right set, and I spun the wheel. Uh-huh. And it's heavy. And most importantly, I met one of the pages who is responsible for writing the name tags.
Oh,
and he was explaining to me how they write the name tags and how they have to use your full legal first name on your name tag.
Really?
So that's why you sometimes wind up with people who have weird looking name tags, because they actually have to. Now, he might have been lying. I don't know.
He was a page.
He was a future filmmaker. I will tell you, he is into film enough and was an early enough adopter on Twitter that he is who you get at Gunga Din.
Well, all right, then.
I remember this.
All right, let's back up. Okay, so the thing about this show is that it doesn't change. You look at this show to this
day. It changes incrementally.
Right, but you get, and this is very intentional on their part, you get 1972 in the color scheme, in the cheapness of the lights that kind of flash around the corner of the screen as they're panning over the audience. You just get the feeling that just outside of camera range, there is some more burnt ochre shag carpeting, and you just, the font, everything about it. And today, when I see the show, I feel, you know, like I'm homesick, like there's toast and ginger ale and The Price is Right.
Yeah.
And it's also kind of sinister. Let's address this because it's basically indoctrinating you into an endless stream of ad copy. It is basically getting you used to product placement. It created product placement by embedding advertisements into the entertainment value of the show. So it's not only just about capitalism, it's about consumerism in a really basic way.
Well, there's a certain amount of like, wow, that toaster oven is a real bargain.
Yeah.
Well, but there's also, I can't believe that Garfield lamp cost $35. <Right. You know? laughs> When I was in college, when Glenn was talking about the limited number of consumer products, it was the Garfield lamp. Uh-huh. And it went around. My friends and I watched The Price is Right religiously in college, as many people did. We actually watched it completely sober, which is not as common.
Yeah.
But between 10 and 11 a.m. or 11, whatever time it airs.
But for a while, it was the Garfield lamp, and it kept showing up. And I believe it was $35. And we knew how much it was. So every time the Garfield lamp came up, it was like, oh, score. We have this knocked because we know how much the Garfield lamp
is. The appeal of the show is very, I mean, it's kind of, this is why I say it's a little sinister, because basically it's trading on knowledge that homemakers have. It's not Jeopardy. It's not even, they don't even need to spell. What they need to do is apply this knowledge that they have because of their day-to-day chores, their day-to-day living, and that's the thing that's of value. Let's just talk about the idea of a pricing game. Like, that's not a thing. That was never a thing before this show. It's kind of a weird thing to say, let's play a pricing game.
But you do have to, I think the kind of knowledge that you're talking about is knowledge that, you know, who's to say that knowing how much a particular bottle of vitamins costs is a less valuable piece of knowledge than knowing who won the World Series?
I'm saying they have engineered the show to appeal to the people watching at home in a very base, strict way.
No, I'm just saying. Oh, my goodness.
There's something about the show that sort of feels dirty.
You know, I'm going to say, I'm with Linda on this. I'm going to say that if your skill is knowing what something should cost, that makes you a valuable asset to almost any enterprise, whether it's keeping a home or running a business.
Well, you know, we are consumers, whether we like it or not. Mm-hmm. You know, we all have to buy things whether we like it or not. Mm-hmm. I do think there are useful skills tied to it. I don't want to stop talking about The Price is Right without mentioning The Golden Road.
The Golden Road is a very hard game.
Which is, a very, very hard game, but B, culminates in a prize that so few people... I feel the same way about the RV at the end of The Golden Road that I also feel about certain boats that they trot out on the show.
Yeah.
Like, what the holy hell am I going to do if I win this prize?
Party boat.
Live in it,
there are times,
of course.
No, but there are times when they're like, it's a pontoon boat. And I'm like, a pontoon boat? What would I do with a pontoon boat?
Well, it's like, I live just outside Washington, D.C. Now, granted, there are bodies of water.
I was going to say, Potomac
nearby.
River. river, Georgetown.
No, yes, I'm going to take a gigantic boat
to Georgetown.
To Georgetown from Silver Spring.
Do you know how expensive it is to keep a boat?
It's like, very
that's
pricey.
What I'm saying.
It's basically they're basically like they're giving you a cow.
Without the advantage of the milk and butter,
which kind of makes the
kind
of makes the
something.
Boat is the zonk prize right. of the Price is Right. Whereas on Let's Make a Deal, when they gave you a cow, they admitted that was a bad prize right. and you lost.
Okay, before we go, it's really very important that we return to cliffhangers.
Yes.
What is the name of the little guy who goes odie odie?
Well, opinion is divided on this question. Some call him Fritz, some call him Little Yodely Guy. I think that's what Drew Carey refers
to. Drew Carey calls him Yodely Guy. It's true. He has no official name. That right. is why opinion is divided.
Right.
He is sometimes called Fritz, including in a notorious incident in 1976 when Dennis James said, "Whoops, there goes Fritz," not knowing that Janice Pennington's husband had just fallen off a mountain.
Oh.
And his name was Fritz.
Yeah.
Oh.
Apparently she spent the rest of the episode weeping backstage.
That is a very tacky
poor
story.
Poor Janice Pennington.
That is a very, very tacky story. There are many tacky stories surrounding
that's
the
That's certainly
right.
true. Let's,
let's acknowledge the backstage
right.
for a moment. They've gotten sued a lot. Bob Barker should have stopped trying to get people to reach in the $100 pocket a lot sooner. And he did. That
right.
is a literal, yeah. when I was in college, oh, he still, if it was a pretty woman up on the stage and she guessed the exact price,
yep.
she won $100, which she would get by coming up on stage, and Bob Barker would literally say, "Reach in the $100 pocket," and she would reach in the pocket of his jacket to retrieve her $100 bill.
Yep, now, if it had been Richard Dawson, it would have
that's
been
okay. yeah.
it would have been a pants pocket.
That's yeah. okay. that's okay.
Telling everybody else to spay and neuter their pets, but apparently, physician, heal thyself.
I do miss Bob Barker. I also terribly miss Rod Roddy.
Oh, yes.
The announcer.
Absolutely.
I have a framed photo of Rod Roddy. It says, "Hey, Steve," because I was Steve back then.
Wow.
Come on down.
Aww.
Rod that's
Roddy.
Wonderful. That's
pouring one out for Rod Roddy.
That's when up there was Super Wishes Dean Cain. All right. Well, come and tell us on the blog, on Facebook, what you think of The Price is Right, which, yes, we really did just spend a segment talking about, because that is how important it is to American
We didn't
culture.
Even get to the whole game theory of bidding, which there are entire web pages devoted to.
There absolutely are. Yeah. We just were too busy fighting about different games.
Mm-hmm.
And Cliffhanger, which is the best. And by the way, I will
plural.
Cliffhangers. I will make sure that I post a good link to the after I wrote about The Price is Right, the head of CBS Daytime tweeted me, and they made a photoshopped Fritz the mountain climber guy with my head photoshopped onto him. And then what I really loved about it, what I really respected about it, was they went to the trouble of then putting the hat on my head, his little hat.
Sure.
Because, I mean, you know, you could just put my head on there.
Mm-hmm.
But they went ahead and finished it with the hat. So we'll put that on there. And that brings us to our final segment, what is making us happy this week? What could make us happier than The Price is Right? I don't
Nothing.
Know. Stephen Thompson, try to hit me with something else making you happy this week.
All right. First of all, Trey sent me this link, and I was delighted that he did. Some enterprising car manufacturer built the Homer.
Yeah.
Which is the car designed by Homer Simpson on an episode of the show with the soundproof bubble dome and the horn that plays La Cucaracha.
Yep.
And did everything that they describe in this episode for the Homer car, which, of course, he has designed through machinations. And the problem with the Homer car is that it costs $82,000. It's supposed to be a car for the average man. And somebody built the Homer car. We will put up a link. There's a YouTube clip of them driving it. It is delightful. I love nerds. So much. I also want to throw, we often praise the NPR Code Switch blog on this show. It continues to be absolutely fantastic. We've had several people involved with it on the show. And I want to call attention, they've been tweeting about iStock Photo and sort of stock photos in general and the incredible unnaturalness thereof. And so they just put up on Instagram today being Monday, a photo of our friend Matt Thompson and our friend Kat Chow posing for their own iStock photo. And it's the two of them are looking up at the camera, grinning, and both of all of their hands are situated on the same laptop. And it's really, really fantastic. I just find them endlessly delightful.
So what you're saying is this is the iStock photo sort of designed for you if you went to iStock and searched on diversity technology.
Yes, and the caption of their Instagram is, the iStock photo caption would read, African-American man and Asian-American woman type on computer. They are excited and looking at the camera.
All right. Trey Graham, what is making you happy this week?
Enchiladas. Enchiladas are making me happy.
Thank you, Trey. And now Glenn.
In particular, Stephen Thompson. Wait for it. A very specific recipe for enchiladas. It is from a Pop Culture Happy Hour listener, and it has been specially chosen for Stephen Thompson to make for his kids.
Excellent.
When you say enchiladas to most people, they kind of think soul food.
This recipe for enchiladas is brought to you by Rick Bayless, chef at Chicago's Topolobampo restaurant and star of the PBS show Mexico, One Plate at a Time. He's a fan of the podcast. And when Stephen announced his project for learning how to cook for his kids, I emailed Rick and asked him for a recipe. He put this recipe together for one of his newer projects, which is a cooking magazine / iPhone app.
For dullards.
Called... no, it's a new magazine / app. Called Panna, P-A-N-N-A. You get recipes, which are fairly straightforward. Those recipes will automatically populate shopping lists for you. But they also have these very nice videos where the chefs are in their kitchens showing you how to do the basic prep. So, Stephen Thompson, this recipe for you, we will share it, we will share the video, and we will put up the recipe for you.
Thank you, Rick Bayless.
Chosen for Stephen Thompson by a genuine celebrity chef.
Yep.
Thank you, Trey Graham, and thank you, Rick Bayless. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
John Hodgman's Ragnarok is a comedy special that is available now on Netflix streaming. It was taped at the Bell House in Brooklyn on the night, right before the midnight of the day that he predicted in his third and final book of Complete World Knowledge, That Is All, the day that the world would end. So you see that setup, and then you see midnight come and go. And the joke of the thing is what happens after that. It's very, very smart. It's very, very funny. That should not surprise anybody because that is that guy. But I've read some reviews that say they find it surprisingly moving, which surprised me because if you read That Is All, you see that he is not just relying on what got him to That Is All. He's not just doing these sort of People's Almanac, Book of Lists type jokes anymore. He's really pushing himself, he's reaching beyond what he's done before, and I admire the hell out of him for doing that. He's finding something that is sincere, and I'm going to go ahead and say wise. So Ragnarok on Netflix streaming, check it out.
Thank you, Glenn Weldon. Making me happy this week, I have two things, a sublime and a ridiculous. The sublime is the Steven Soderbergh film Side Effects, which I had not seen until just recently. Side Effects stars Rooney Mara, Channing Tatum, Catherine Zeta-Jones, and Jude Law.
You remember this beautiful lady here?
Hi.
How have things been going with you?
I can finally sleep. I have some energy. We had sex.
Whoever makes this drug is going to be rich.
911, what's your emergency?
I need help. Someone's been murdered.
There's been an incident.
What do we do?
It was very hard to tell what movie is this from the trailer. What you saw in the trailer was Rooney Mara plays this woman who is depressed and she goes on a new medication and clearly it's something bad happens. And then Jude Law is her doctor and did he give her something he shouldn't have given her? Did she get screwed up? Did something bad happen? Is the drug company involved? Is there some kind of whatever? And I kept seeing reviews at the time that said, it's hard to even explain to you what genre of movie this is without ruining it.
Which is because it's at least two movies.
It is. But I think that the thing to say about it is it's kind of a mystery thriller. If you like sort of psychological thrillers where perhaps there's a turn and you have a little trouble telling who the good guy is and who the bad guy is, it's a really good movie. I also heard somebody, after I had mentioned on Twitter that I had just watched it and really enjoyed it, but wasn't sure what to say about it, there was somebody who said that the most interesting theory they had heard was that it was a riff on Psycho, which I don't think that's quite true, but I understand how they got there. So Side Effects, really good and interesting, but also fun. I think I sort of thought it was going to be more meditative, like more of a let's talk about our culture of antidepressants and things like that. It's not really about that. It's a thriller. It's fun.
I enjoyed the heck out of that movie. Yeah. And I would say, don't think about it too hard. Don't look for life's meanings in it. Just go and enjoy it.
Right. It is a fun movie, and I think everybody's good in it, and I enjoyed it a lot. The Ridiculous is the new-ish ABC reality series, Whodunit.
13 strangers will be arriving here to play a game.
I sell frozen food. I had football coach.
A former Miss Nevada. Let's have a lot of fun.
Cheers.
But what they don't know is the game is murder.
Now, Whodunit is one of the weirdest reality shows I've seen in quite some time. It is essentially the murder mystery party game. So there's a bunch of contestants, and each week somebody gets quote-unquote killed off. And then the rest of the people run around and try to solve it. It took me forever to figure out how this show works, despite the fact that it's kind of stupid. So, because they don't explain it very well.
It's like the pirate master of its time.
Exactly. But essentially what happens is somebody gets killed. Everybody else tries to solve it. And whoever does the worst job solving it gets killed next time. So at the end, you have to give all your guesses and try to guess what's going on. And if you do the worst in the little quiz at the end, you're the one who gets killed next. And there is a killer, I think, but they don't tell you, like, during the game who the killer is. I think at the end, one of them is going to turn out to be the killer, but I'm not sure about that.
Sounds a little bit like...
I thought you were going to say, at the end, Truman Capote emerges.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not actually sure
how... It sounds a little bit like The Mole.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a little bit like The Mole. It needs more of that part. And Andy Dennard from Reality Blurred was saying this, too, that it needs a little more of The Mole and a little bit less of the other stuff. But
everything.
But it is kind of similar to The Mole, with the exception of the fact that they do a lot of this forensic stuff where, like, they run around going, we have to look at the evidence, we have to look at the body, and they give you all kinds of little clues, and then you run around looking for clues, and it's very stupid, but it's sort of...
Can the audience pick up on it? Can the audience solve it, or are we just sitting watching other people run around?
You're just watching other people. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can guess, like, as you watch, but of course, they have to decide. As they go around and gather clues, they don't all get the same information, so you have to decide how much information you're going to share with each other, because if you and I are both trying to solve it, and we learn different things, if we share, then we might both get closer to solving it, but if I leave you in the dark, then maybe you'll do a worse job than I will, and you'll get killed next time instead of me.
But I'm trying to figure out what's in it for the viewer, because Glenn's question sort of makes me think that watching this would be kind of like if you were in the 80s and one of your friends had one of those boxed sets of Murder Mystery Dinner Party or whatever it was. It would be like being the 11th person who got invited to this party.
Yeah, the guest who showed up late.
Yeah, right? So no card for you, role.
Kind of. It's not great. I'm not saying it's great.
Well, as far as, you know, summer reality shows
go. It is a stupid summer reality show. Okay. And some of us, Stephen Thompson, for example.
Right. I enjoy coming back and having Big Brother teach me how to hate again.
Oh, yeah. My goodness. Those people are, as Tara Ariano has now said about four times on Twitter, human garbage.
Oh, like, man.
From top to bottom.
Alrighty then.
And I could not entirely disagree with that, at least as an assessment of how they appear on television. At any rate, those are the things making me happy this week. Side effects for the good part of you.
Fun movie.
And whodunit for the stupid part of you. Your internal me. So that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham. That's Trey with an E.
Like enchiladas.
And Graham like the cracker. You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon, WELDON. You can follow our producer, Jess Gittner. Back from vacation, we're so happy to see her at Jess Gittner, G.I.T.N.E.R. You can follow our esteemed producer, emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, K.A.T.Z.I.F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music, which you are bobbing your head to right now. So thanks to you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.